This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Well, the oil industry was in a slump before the pandemic struck. COVID-19 made a bad situation worse. North Dakota leaders chose to use millions of dollars of CARES Act funding to help put people back to work in the oil patch, but the decision met some resistance. Our news director, Dave Thompson, recently sat down with State Mineral Resource Director Lynn Helms to talk about the CARES funding and other issues for his ongoing series, Energy Issues and Answers, Oil Well Reclamation.
Let's start talking about the new project, which is the money now will be going toward fracking oil wells, correct?
Yeah, that's right, Dave. So the new project is a repurposing of some of the $66.4 million that was originally appropriated. It's not new funds, but it's a repurposing of part of that. And the idea is to incentivize the completion of what we call duck wells, wells that have been drilled for some time but have been left uncompleted because of the low oil price. And we want to incentivize about 80 of those wells between now and the end of the year in order to stabilize North Dakota's production at the current levels so we can keep tax revenues flowing, we can keep jobs out there, get people off unemployment.
How does that relate to wells that have been shut in so far?
Yeah, so when you look at the numbers, we've got about 850 of these duck wells. At one point in time, we had over 7,500 wells shut in. That number has come down dramatically to where it's less than 1,000 wells now that are shut in. And so we've seen as prices got above $35 a barrel, West Texas, it was economic to put those wells back on production, almost all of them. And so we've seen those wells come back on. We've seen production rise now to about 1.2 million barrels a day. Maybe 1.3. I think we're more at the 1.2 level. And so the price that it takes, though, to complete a duck well is $10 higher. It requires about $45 a barrel, West Texas. And then the price that it takes to put drilling rigs back to work, actually drilling new wells for most of the Bakken, is about $55 per barrel. So wells that were shut in started to come back at $35 a barrel. Wells that have been drilled but left uncompleted, we're still not there. There's so much oil in storage around the world that the price just can't really get above that $41 level on any given day.
But the thing that reaches out to me is that we do have wells ready to be fracked. And there are a number of wells. It seems like a pretty good little bank account there, perhaps.
Right. That's a great point, Dave. And we've had Justin Kringsted with the Pipeline Authority do an analysis. He says that at least half of those duck wells will be economic to complete at $45 oil. So we have a bank account, wells already drilled but left uncompleted. If all those wells are completed, that gives us the capacity to keep our production stable for maybe 18 months, even in the absence of drilling rigs going back to work. We think that by this time next year, the price will be high enough to sustain fracking duck wells or completing duck wells on its own with no incentive, and that within the following year, by this time 2 years out, prices should have recovered enough that drilling rigs will go back to work.
What kind of response have you had from industry about the interest in using this incentive to get wells completed?
We've had great response. So it's been mixed. The very large publicly traded oil companies all responded by saying, wow, we've already set our budgets for the remainder of this year and next year. We just can't pivot that quickly to use this money in November and December of 2020. But we're fortunate. We've got about 35% of the wells in North Dakota are operated by what we consider small to medium-sized independents. They're not publicly traded. They get their money from venture capital funds, not from stock, and they're able to move very quickly. So we polled those companies. We've now got five now of those companies now that have lined up and said, we think we've got 67 of these wells that we can commit to completing in November and December. So our goal is 80. We're pretty sure we got 67 already lined up.
Not bad. More than two-thirds at this point.
Correct. Yes.
So when you're talking about a frac crew, how many jobs are we talking about?
Great question. And so you're talking about supporting 100 full-time jobs. Now, not every one of those people work for the company who's actually performing the hydraulic fracture job. Probably about a third of them are actually, you know, moving that iron and running those big diesel engines to pump the water and the sand. But there's a whole another group of people that deliver diesel fuel. Those trucks run 24 hours a day for 5 to 10 days out there pumping one of these frac jobs. And so there's actually at least two people that do nothing but haul diesel fuel to that frac job to keep the trucks running. Water is hauled. Lay flat pipe is put on the ground. There's a flowback crew that has to come in and flow the frac fluid back out of the well. There's truckers delivering the sand. So all in all, each frac crew puts 100 people to work. And when we look at the September 2020 unemployment statistics out there in the oil patch, they're pretty startling. So these jobs are badly needed. We think we're going to put somewhere between 650 and 1,200 people back to work.
And putting them back to work kind of lessens the pressure on our unemployment fund at that point.
It does, Dave. When you think about it, if they remain on unemployment, they're going to draw that fund down. If we put them back to work, they're going to be paying into that fund. And so it's a huge net positive for WSI and for the unemployment. And, you know, we're seeing numbers in Williams County above 10% unemployment, which is, you know, five times what the statewide average is. So I think the good news from that standpoint is that the school enrollments haven't dropped. We don't have a massive surge of moving trucks leaving the area. So the people are still there. They still want to work in the North Dakota oil patch. We just need to get them working through November and December. And then some of the jobs that we're going to generate are 30 to 40-year jobs. So every one of these wells that gets completed creates 1.5 to 2 production jobs that will last for 30 or 40 years. So there's some real long-term benefit to this two-month surge.
I'm curious, how long does it take normally to frac a well, to complete the frac process?
Great question. And so an individual well in today's world with 50 to 60 frac stages and 200,000 to 250,000 barrels of water, 10 million pounds of frac sand going in, the record is about 5 days. It runs anywhere from 5 to 10 days. So the crews are constantly changing out. They typically run 12-hour shifts. And so you got two of everybody. And so they'll be out there 24 hours a day for as much as 10 days on that location.
And you're talking 67 wells, so there's a lot of work to do yet.
There's a tremendous amount of work to do. And when you look at a modern Bakken well, based on the numbers that we've been seeing in the cases that are presented to us, the drilling part of the well cost is about $2.5 to $3 million. The frac job itself is about $5 million. So the bulk of the money goes into the completion of the well. One of the huge benefits of this project is that everything except the water is subject to sales tax, and so all of that other stuff that goes into the ground other than the water is subject to sales tax. And we're anticipating generating around $11 million in sales tax.
So you've got that. You've got sales to WAS, as you mentioned during the budget section meeting. That there's a few ways this is going to help and help our bottom line as we try to recover from this pandemic.
Absolutely. And so this is going to ripple through the local economies out there in a very big way. Of course, the state gets a share of that sales tax, but so does the local county and the city and all of that. WAS is very important to our western North Dakota communities in terms of their local water supply. And with the downturn, it hasn't been easy for WAS. This looks like it could generate $2 million in revenue for WAS, which will greatly benefit that project and keep it moving forward. On top of that, these 80 wells are going to generate millions and millions of dollars of production and extraction tax, and that goes to every single citizen in North Dakota. That goes into water projects. It goes into the schools. It goes into the cities and the counties. And we're even going to be able to put some money into the Prairie Dog budget for infrastructure if we can get these 80 wells completed. You know, we weren't expecting much to flow in there with what's happened to production. But if we can maintain 1.2 to 1.3 million barrels a day, we're going to get some money into that bucket.
You're pretty confident that this is going to maintain that level, correct?
Yes. That's really the second purpose of this project. Number one purpose is put people to work, get them off unemployment, get them out there working. But the number two purpose of this is that this surge in well completions has the potential to carry us through with sustained 1.2 million barrel a day production all the way through the middle of next year, at which time we think oil prices will have recovered to the point that fracking of duck wells, completing of duck wells will sustain itself.
And, of course, that you're kind of – that's your forecast into the future, you know, if everything goes the way it's supposed to be going, I guess.
Yes, that's absolutely right. If things – in the absence of this incentive, we're really only anticipating about 25, maybe 30 wells a month to be completed. That means that by the end of this fiscal year, we're back down below 1.1 million barrels a day. We're pushing the 1 million barrel a day mark and dropping. And, of course, once that curve tips over and starts down on a natural decline, it's a huge amount of work to reverse that. So maintaining that flat curve until we see some price recovery is going to be fantastic. Now, we are going to add some downward pressure to the oil market because that's 200,000 barrels a day that wouldn't be on the market, that will now, that we anticipate. But OPEC is holding back 9 million barrels a day. So 200,000 barrels versus 9 million is not a really significant amount. That's the oil that's in storage, and the OPEC plus production restrictions are what really is going to determine 2021-2022 oil prices.
Now, this money, of course, is repurposed, as you mentioned, from the original $66 million from the CARES Act, which was to go to reclamation of oil wells. How far did you get on the project?
Well, that project's going really well, Dave, and I'm glad you asked that question. So phase one of that project was to plug somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 orphan wells. We're on well number 160 today. So we're out of – as it turns out, the current number, it's a little bit fluid because some operators are plugging wells themselves and taking care of things. So the current number is 360 wells. We're plugging well number 160 today. So we're just about halfway there, and we're about halfway into the project. So we're really happy that first $33 million, we're very confident – we're going to get that spent this year, and we're going to get those wells plugged. Now, we're only on reclamation site number 49. I think we're going to add number 50 before the end of the week. But that leaves us with a lot of reclamation work that, because of winter coming, we're not going to be able to complete. We think that we'll get, at best, half of the reclamation work done this year, and the other half – about 174 sites is going to roll over into next year. That'll have to be done in the spring and fall of next year. And that's where the $16 million comes from then. We were given $33 million for plugging wells and another $33 million for reclaiming sites. We're going to spend the plugging money, but the site reclamation, we're only going to be able to spend about half of it. So we came up with the idea through the Bakken Restart Task Force of repurposing most of that other half into some other kind of jobs project for Western North Dakota, and that's where the duck well incentive came from.
So then you do expect that the $66 million is going to be spent by the deadline, which I think is December 31, correct?
That's right. Midnight of December 30, the money has to be spent. And so our expectation is that we'll spend the $66 million by that deadline, especially by repurposing this and the fact that we've already got 67 out of 80 duck well commitments.
I'm curious, though, going forward, do you think that this reclamation project might have some legs beyond the CARES money?
Dave, I do. We've got about $26 million in the Abandoned Well Site Restoration Fund, and we've committed a significant amount of that, $8 million over the next 5 years, to the old brine pond situation that developed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So we've set that aside, and that's where that's going to go. But we've got the money to reclaim the other half of the sites next year. And we're actually working with Congress, Congressman Armstrong and Congresswoman Torres Small from New Mexico have sponsored a bill to take our type of program nationwide. Through the Department of Interior, they are introducing a bill that would provide $25 million per state in grant money to do exactly what we're doing in North Dakota with the CARES Act money. People took a look at this and said, this is a way for us to get ourselves out of the orphan well program problem, I should say, the orphan well problem that we have nationwide. And, of course, North Dakota with only 400 is super, super small. Many states have thousands of these kind of wells and sites that need to be plugged and reclaimed. So they're looking at a multi-year program, 5 or 10 years. Of up to $25 million per state to do this type of program in North Dakota as well as other states. I'd like to, you know, just add one more point, and that is that we're only incentivizing about 40 to 50% of the water acquisition and disposal costs. So we arrived at that number with the idea that we want to encourage operators to be conservative with the amount of water that they use in these completions, to try to reduce the amount and get a greater benefit out of the $200,000 incentive. So we didn't want to just offer to pay whatever they wanted to spend on water. We wanted to provide an incentive for them to be conservative. And then the last thing is that this industry that provides the completion water and disposes of the water when it comes back from the frack treatment is a local North Dakota industry. These are North Dakota citizens who own these businesses, and they will be providing the water and they will be disposing of the flowback water. So there are additional jobs that we're going to stimulate. And I've gotten some thank you emails from some of the disposal companies saying, It's been a very hard year. We're looking forward to disposing of the fluid that comes from these CARES Act duck completions.
All right. I have to ask the follow-up question. Where does that water go that has been disposed of? Where do you put it?
Great question. So we are blessed with a geologic formation. We typically call it the Dakota. It's actually specifically the Inyankara Formation. It exists statewide, even extends into Montana and South Dakota. And so it's brine water that's in that geologic formation right now. And so we put all of our waste brine into that formation. We got a few spots where the pressure is rising in that formation, but for the most part, it's got virtually unlimited capacity to accept this wastewater. And so it's going into the Indian Kara Formation. It's located about 5,000 to 6,000 feet below the surface. It is separated from our drinking water sources by 2,500, about a half a mile of bentonite shale. So we're blessed with almost the perfect disposal formation for underground injection of our wastewater.
Our news director, Dave Thompson, in a conversation with State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms. You can find more of Dave's energy series at prairiepublic.org. Again, it's called Energy Issues and Answers, Oil Well Reclamation. Next on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
As the pandemic spreads, schools that had resumed in-person learning are making plans to go virtual again. Can kids and their parents make it work?
It feels like everybody's kind of going about their business and we're just trying to survive it.
Navigating another strange school year on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As the editor of Indian Country Today, Mark Trahant also writes and delivers commentaries from a Native perspective. Today, Mark talks about the pandemic and vaccines and our responsibilities toward others.
The pharmaceutical company Pfizer said last week that its vaccine trials are showing its shots are 90% effective at preventing COVID-19. So sometime this month, the company is expected to file an emergency use application, and then people can start getting the shots. There remains a lot of work to do. Before the vaccine can get general approval, at least beyond the emergency phase, it will have to be tested in at least 30,000 people in order to gain a large enough pool of data. That information will tell researchers how the vaccine works, and more important, why it does not work. No vaccine is perfect. The trick is to make the drug work and be safe for as many of us as possible. Pfizer is not the only vaccine. Several clinical trials are wrapping up, and we could have a number of options soon. The plan is for regional governments, including tribes, to work with the federal government on a distribution plan. The first vaccines will go to healthcare workers and other high-risk individuals. Experts say most people won't see a vaccine, any vaccine, until early next year. Infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci said that by April there should be vaccines available for all. But even then, the vaccine will take time to work with our body's immune system. Vaccines are tricky in Indian Country. We know that influenza continues to kill people, and that disease can be prevented with a vaccine. Yet, year after year, only about 30% of us bother to get the shot. We really have to do better this time. Vaccines are the key step toward getting herd immunity, meaning that the virus cannot transmit as easily because fewer people will be able to host the disease. So a solution is coming, slowly. Dr. Fauci hopes it means we can get back to normal by the end of 2021. But for the next few months, we will have to live with this virus, and that means our lives will continue to be disrupted. The immediate concern is Thanksgiving. It's so human to want to gather together with loved ones during this time. Human and dangerous. Our best bet is to stay home, continue the quarantine with your household, and wait for better times. Some are planning outdoor family events, if that's even possible, or drive-by feasts. Some I know are doing Zoom day calls, sharing a meal and conversation virtually. Whatever works, stay safe. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, farming for beginners and hopeful entrepreneurs. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality has a banner on its website saying free radon tests are not available. And there are reasons for that. DEQ's Justin Otto says one of those reasons concerns testing of schools for the odorless, colorless gas.
We haven't tested the schools in North Dakota since the 90s, and we felt that it's time to go back into the schools and to see what the radon levels are there, because we want to make sure that kids are safe in the schools, the teachers, all the staff are safe.
Otto says 2 years ago, 26 schools in southwestern North Dakota were tested. He says over the past year, DEQ was hoping to test 45 schools, but COVID hit, and the department only got 26 of the schools tested. He says once COVID is more under control, the department will restart its testing program. Also, Otto says DEQ goes to home shows across the state.
And there are slips available for the public to take from our booth. They put their mailing address on, send it in to us, and we're sending them a free radon test kit out.
Otto says January is Radon Action Month, and the plan is to have free radon test kits available.
We just have to see how much funding we have available and how many radon test kits that we can allocate to that.
And a report from the American Lung Association says more people in North Dakota receive lung cancer treatment than anywhere else in the country. And the report says while the survival rate in North Dakota is now 22.8%, lung cancer remains the leading cause of cancer deaths. But it also says more indigenous people are being diagnosed with lung cancer. Pat McCone is the senior director of the Lung Association. She says the rate of use of commercial tobacco products among indigenous people is much higher than the general population.
So I think we really have to look at adapting and adopting programs that meet the needs of treatment for nicotine addiction with the indigenous people in ways that respect the culture and the community. And I'm really hoping that the tribes work together to look at the ways we can reduce the levels of commercial tobacco smoking and reduce the levels of exposure to secondhand smoke.
McCone says North Dakota has come a long way in terms of its Clean Indoor Air Act, but she says the state's tax on cigarettes is 49th in the country.
And we know from lots of good public health science that raising the price of commercial tobacco products is one of the most effective ways to support people quitting.
Several attempts have been made to raise the state's tobacco tax. All have failed, but McCone says the association plans to keep at it until those taxes are raised. And six people have applied for an open seat on the State Board of Higher Education. That seat has been open since August when Fargo attorney Joseph Wetch resigned. The six are Matthew Dunleavy and Bruce Jovig of Grand Forks, Perry Lubbers of Castleton, Jerry Newharth of Fargo, Mark Nygaard of Hazen, and John Warford of Bismarck. A selection committee will meet on Friday to recommend three names to Governor Doug Burgum. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And today, Stephanie Bloomhagen joins us. She's the Executive Director of FARMS. That's the Foundation for Agricultural and Rural Resource Management. Thanks for joining us today, Stephanie.
Happy to be here.
Well, I just explained what that abbreviation means, but what is FARMS? How would you describe it to somebody, you know, if you were meeting someone in an elevator who didn't know anything about it?
Sure. You know, we have been around for 20 years, and we exist to grow sustainable agriculture in North Dakota. We have a wide array of educational programs and loans for financial support, and our goal is to help farmers implement more sustainable practices and help more beginning farmers get started farming. We want to create sustainable local food systems in North Dakota.
So how do you describe sustainable agriculture? I assume everybody who's farming wants it to work from year to year.
Right. Our definition of sustainable means that farmers are making decisions and using practices that address the environmental, social, and financial sustainability of their farm and their communities. So they're thinking about the whole system and how the pieces fit together. And it's not just focused on one aspect. True sustainability is about thinking, you know, how is this practice or this this crop or this project, how is this going to impact the long-term health and wellness of my family and community? How is this going to contribute to bettering the environment and stewarding natural resources? And how is this contributing to my financial bottom line and longevity of my enterprise?
So who belongs?
Anybody who wants to learn more about where their food comes from, start a farm, or practice a more sustainable lifestyle. We say that we have programs for people, whether you are planting your first garden or whether you've been farming for decades, or even if you just want to get more in touch with your local food system and get a better idea of who's growing your food and where it's coming from.
Well, you've been around for 20 years, as you mentioned, so how many members do you have?
We're not technically a membership organization, but we have served, I believe, over 160 farmers have gone through our Farm Beginnings entrepreneurship course and launched a new farm. We've given close to over 60 to 70 loans in our lifetime. We serve interns every year. We place them on farms for an on-farm learning experience. You know, it's challenging to give you a specific number, but we've had quite a few participants over the years.
And how is Farms funded?
Great question. We always accept donations and we pursue sponsorships each year. We also write grants to federal entities and foundations to support a lot of our programs. It's important to us that our programs are accessible. So while we do charge fees for the Farm Beginnings course, most of the other courses are free. And Farm Beginnings, we offer lots of scholarships.
And there's a lot of information on your website. That's farmswith2rs.org. How has the pandemic affected operations for your participants, so the people who do sustainable agriculture?
We had already been trying out a hybrid in-person online model for our Farm Beginnings course. So in March, we went to entirely online programming. For our interns, there weren't a lot of changes because they're outdoors, they're in small groups, but their orientation went online. For local foods in general, the pandemic meant that a lot of consumers were looking for more local foods. They were turning to their local farmers as a source of safe food, a safe way to shop. Farmers markets emerged as a safe way to get groceries because they're outdoors. It's easier to social distance. And so our role was to look at our programming and find ways that we could teach farmers how to reach out to their customers and offer their products online and market online to reach those new consumers who were looking for more local options. So we offered an online marketing series this summer, and all of those recordings are on our website. And we are offering free assistance for any farmer who wants to set up a website or an online shop in partnership with a marketing expert in Fargo.
So this is different, obviously, than what we'd think of as commodity agriculture, monoculture. Maybe I'm growing, 1,000 acres of soybeans or something like this. This is more niche market. And because of that, because you're not selling into a commodity market, you need to basically identify who you are, what you've got, and find a customer, right?
Exactly. All of our farmers are small business owners. We're helping them move from a hobbyist mindset to an entrepreneurial mindset. And so these are the people that you'll see at your local farmers market. Some of them are marketing to schools and restaurants, although that market was affected by the pandemic this year. A lot of our farmers market to the Bisman Food Co-op in Bismarck. They operate CSAs and market directly to shoppers in their home communities. So these are your friends and neighbors who are growing food right here at home.
Well, you did mention the challenge that was reflected in the, you know, the experience we're living through right now, this pandemic. Farmers markets were affected somewhat. They were, the one in Fargo, for example, was separated by more space than usual. And if restaurants aren't buying produce directly from farmers because their capacity has been greatly reduced, that certainly would seem to affect the bottom line. And these small growers are producing something that doesn't have a forever shelf life. So what are the, I guess, the real challenges right now that are facing people who want to do what you're advocating?
Scale is certainly a challenge. It's necessary to scale up or collaborate to reach larger markets and increase your profit margins. So we do partner with the North Dakota Local Food Development Alliance to look at ways that farms and many other food organizations across the state can support the development of food hubs, help farmers aggregate their produce to reach wholesale markets and those institutional markets, again, like the farm to school or farm to institution, farm to hospital. Processing facilities, there's definitely a need for that. With the increase in demand for local meat processors were, you know, at capacity. So fortunately, the Department of Ag offered some grant funding to meat processors to expand their facilities. So those are a couple of the challenges that we that I observe in our local food system.
The website, again, is farms.org, farms with two R's, and there's a Facebook page as well. And Stephanie Bloomhagen is the executive director of FARMS, which stands for Foundation for Agricultural and Rural Resource Management. Stephanie, when I went to your Facebook page, there's a lot up there about marketing, and this makes me wonder about the local piece here. What is local? By the definition you would operate on, and isn't it possible that some of these niche marketers would have something that would travel well and might be distributed beyond what might be defined as local?
Lots of different entities have their own definitions of local. I think the USDA says fits within 400 miles of where it's been grown. You know, we serve producers in North Dakota and western Minnesota. You know, some of our farmers are just across the Red River. The local is about knowing who grew your food and who your farmer is. Having that relationship with where your food came from. So, yeah, it's definitely possible to ship some of these foods. Depending on what it is, there are some guidelines about cottage food laws and online sales and shipping. We went into that on in a webinar we had on August 6th on local online sales of cottage foods, and that's on our webpage if anyone wants to watch the recording. That's a whole additional layer of packaging and shipping. And we can, connect farmers to other farmers who are experimenting with some of that. We are focused on creating peer support networks among farmers. So all of our programming is farmer led. So everything we teach is taught by a farmer who's doing it.
It would seem that the pandemic has, though, affected, markets for a number of these niche farmers. When I go to a restaurant, for example, some restaurants will list this piece of the meal came from such and such a farm or such and such an operation. And if those restaurants aren't open, that market's closed. So is part of the process that you're in right now, updating your website, communicating via Facebook, suggesting other options for farmers who have lost market?
Absolutely, yes. And marketing is a big part of our Farm Beginnings course, where we teach farmers to create a farm business plan and a sustainability plan for their farm business. So it's, adaptability. If one market is closing, what other markets are available to you? What kind of adaptations will you have to make to reach other markets? So some of our farmers were selling to the Prairie Roots Food Co-op in Fargo. And when that closed, they had to adapt and shift to, more CSA sales, more farmers market sales, and other means. So, yeah, we try to support all parts of the local food system so that farmers have other options if one market becomes unavailable.
Are there niche markets that are particularly attractive right now? I mean, even if a pandemic weren't here, for example, is there a market for more people to produce honey or more people to grow apples or something like that?
Meat has definitely been in demand this season. I've seen Facebook groups pop up sort of organically, just by producers and consumers. And a lot of the consumers I saw in those groups were looking for locally grown meat and eggs. I think produce is always in demand. And we have a lot of farmers who are trying niche markets and non-conventional crops. We've seen producers growing microgreens, mushrooms. A lot of farmers are trying out hemp these days, and I'm always encouraged by the innovation that I see in our farmers, the wide variety of products they're producing. Oh, and of course, I can't forget the cottage foods and the processed foods. We have bakers and jam and jelly makers. Farmers are finding ways to use to process the produce that can't be sold, or if there's a lot of green tomatoes, they can turn them into like a relish. I was really encouraged by the innovation that I see in our farmers.
So that would be like value-added operations. You grow the produce, yes. And then you package it in some way that gives it, well, more value to a consumer. Are many of the people who subscribe to your goals, your mission, they might be commodity farmers with a side operation, or are these people who are starting up something with like 20 acres and hoping to, make a living from it?
All of the above. We get the full spectrum of students in our Farm Beginnings course from, people who have a traditional commodity farm, and one member of the family wants to start a market garden and sell at the farmer's market. We have young people who are just, recently graduated from college wanting to start a new farm. We have urban farmers in Grand Forks and Fargo who are trying, indoor enterprises like microgreens or farming in their backyard and taking it to farmers market. We have in the past worked with New Americans in Fargo who were farming in community gardens.
Well, it would seem that this would be an opportunity for people who wanted maybe a career change or to look at farming because, if you're going to start a 1,000-acre commodity farm operation, you'd have to be a millionaire or have access to millions of dollars because of the price of land. So This is an entry-level opportunity for people to live off the land, if you will.
Absolutely, yes. if you focus on a high-value specialty crop, you can have a farm enterprise on fewer than, as few as 3 acres or less than an acre. Mm. We have farmers who are starting aquaponics operations, which are largely indoors in a greenhouse or a high tunnel. We have a Farm Dreams course coming up that's on our website. And it's for anyone who's ever dreamed of starting their own farm business, and we'll help you think about the challenges and the rewards that you might be getting into and assess your readiness to pursue your farm dream.
Well, if I go to the bank and say I want to start growing heritage tomatoes, it might be a little bit of a tough sell to the loan officer. So is there assistance, financial assistance, through farms or through other organizations that you direct people to for grants or loans?
I am glad you asked. Yes. For that very reason, we operate our own loan program. We make small loans up to about $7,500 for farmers who are starting out or expanding their operations. Our loans are focused on sustainability. You know, how is what you're requesting funding for going to improve the sustainability of your farm in all those ways that I mentioned before, social, economic, and environmental? We have recently partnered with Dakota Business Lending, and they are servicing our loans. So we're grateful for this new partnership, and I think it will improve the sustainability of this loan program.
What would be the typical time from somebody deciding, you know, I'm going to get into this, and taking a course from you online, this beginning farmer course, and, you know, planting something or starting an operation and then having something to sell? Is there a timeline that is typical?
I think everybody's farm journey is unique and a little different. My advice to our farm beginning students would be to just try it on a small scale. You know, plant a little bit of something, bake a little something, make a few jars of jam, and go to your local farmer's market if they'll accept new vendors. For one or two Saturdays in the summer, see how you like it. And if it works well, you know, expand a little bit at a time. But it definitely takes more than a year, probably more than 3 years. It's a process. It's a growing process. And I think most of our farmers find that what they start out doing is not what they end up doing. Their farm enterprise changes over the year as they discover which crops grow better in their soils and climate, and what there's a market for in their area, and what meets their quality of life needs and what makes them happy.
Stephanie Bloomhagen is the Executive Director of Farms. You can find out lots more information at Farms, FARRMS.org, or you can go on Facebook, farms.nd. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 17th. Typhoid is caused by bacteria associated with human waste. In the fall of 1893, Crookston, Minnesota had several dozen cases of typhoid, and as a precaution, the authorities, on this date, flushed the city's backed-up sewer main into the Red Lake River. Bad idea. Practically every downstream neighbor was affected, from farmhouses to small towns. Grand Forks, which had about 8,000 residents, was hit the hardest, with a typhoid outbreak about a month after the Crookston flush.
Grand Forks drew its drinking water from where the Red Lake River met the Red River. One out of every nine Grand Forks residents was sickened that winter. More than 80 people died. The epidemic peaked in January with 52 typhoid deaths. One Sunday saw 21 funerals. Grand Forks hospitals were at capacity. Doctors and nurses were stretched thin. A Grand Forks Citizens Committee led an investigation into the epidemic. The situation created alarm in downstream Winnipeg, where a newspaper ad promoting a $6 water filter warned residents there is death in Red River water. A physician visited towns along the two rivers and found other outbreaks, including as many as 23 cases in a tiny river town east of Grafton. Lab analysis of water samples confirmed the water was unfit for use, and residents were advised to boil it. The North Dakota State Board of Health prohibited the sale of ice cut from the rivers that winter. Train passengers were fearful of stopping in Grand Forks. Former North Dakota State Auditor Archie Curry was one of those who died in the outbreak. He was 40 years old. The following summer, Grand Forks built a new water filtration plant for $40,000 that included a 1-million-gallon covered water reservoir and a 147,000-gallon settling basin. The city used a new experimental sand filter for the plant. This cutting-edge system was only the third plant of its kind in the nation and the only one west of New York. The year after the epidemic, Grand Forks logged only 3 typhoid cases and 0 deaths during the same 6-month period. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
What's for dinner tonight in Bulgaria?
Our main course, of course, a lot of grilled and barbecued meats. We have kebabche or kofte.
In the southwest of France, they like duck.
In Gascony, duck fat is what you cook with, and it lends a depth of flavor to almost everything.
And learn how olive oil is the heart of a Mediterranean diet.
The Italians say their olives are better.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, health centers provide many North Dakota communities with health care regardless of insurance status or ability to pay. On our show tomorrow, we'll talk with Dr. Matt Eaton. He's with Family Healthcare in Fargo, and we'll talk about how services have adapted to help manage the pandemic. And we'll talk with Patrick Hicks, the author of In the Shadow of Dora, a novel that connects an infamous Nazi slave labor camp during the Holocaust with the Apollo moon landing. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.